If you had some money to burn, what would you do with it? Perhaps attend a sugar daddy's party?
This is actually called Sugar Affairs.
A Sugar Affairs.
And we have sugar daddies and sugar babies showing up at the party, hoping to find the perfect match between, obviously, themselves.
So the name implies that the daddies have money.
That's right. The daddies have money, but we also have the mummies, and the mummies have money too. And these are the successful, wealthy, and generous men and women who want to meet, hopefully find their baby.
People who spend money in showy ways are often seeking to project or confirm their social and financial status. They're saying, I have arrived and you should know it. The handbags, the jewels, the cars, the boats, even the alcohol they drink are all signifiers to impress and attract others. This is the BBC World Service. I'm Alvin Hall, and in Miser's Bling and the Money Thing, I'm delving beneath the bling, exploring the motivations and spending of people with money. In cities around the world, there are places where rich men and women go to meet prospective partners with the understanding that they will financially support them. I went to one such event in New York City. The men are extremely well-groomed. You'd expect to have collars that are too big or bad dye jobs. None of that. They're few, but not very many. The women, however, have amped up the sex. They make themselves look as attractive as possible. The dresses are all short and tight. The shoes are vertiginous, to say the least. And when you combine all of this with the mask that both the men and the women are wearing, it adds a sort of Phantom of the Opera quality to the evening. They really don't know what they're getting. It's interesting to watch the body language. Some women are standing there clearly not interested, being very formal, but those that are laughing and throwing their heads back as if they're in a movie, and the guys are talking very intensely. When you hear about this event, you would think that the men would come off to show their bling, but that's not where it is. It's the women. The women are wearing shoes that say money, handbags that say money, little necklaces that say Tiffany's or Bulgari. They have all those little signs. And I guess rather than being about bling, their choices are designed to illustrate their good taste. So if you are a guy who's interested in them, you have to worry about whether or not they know how to act at a good restaurant or how to shop or to act around your friends. You know that they have the essence of those things already. That's what they're trying to telescope with their accoutrements. Brandon Wade is the founder of SecretArrangement.com. When people come here and they see the name, do you think they really think money first, or do they think love first?
I think people might think money first, but you know, at the end of the day, relationships all start out at a very superficial level. Something needs to be a debate to attract the fish to show up. Because if you look at a lot of guys out there, they go to the gym every day. What are they working for? They're working for those huge muscles and six-pack abs. And that's also a bait. And then you have the pickup artists who learn how to charm and whine and perhaps a, you know, sweet talk a woman. That's also a bait. So what's wrong with simply flashing some of your cash? There's nothing wrong with that. But I will say, money cannot buy love. Money can only buy you a chance at love. The rest is all up to you.
Let's leave the sugar daddies and their babies to mingle for now and meet someone else whose earnings have let him live a life that I have only tasted a little of.
I'm relaxed. My boat's a 100-year-old sailing boat. And actually, after I finish speaking to you, there's a nice gentle breeze. We're just going to go out for an afternoon sail. So
fantastic. Peter, it sounds like a luxurious life. Peter DeSavory has had too many business interests to list, but among them are the owning of exclusive worldwide resorts and country house hotels. He started by importing wheat, flour, steel, and other essentials into post-war Nigeria. By the age of 30, he was a millionaire, having left school at 17.
Peter, who was on his yacht in Palma when we chatted, is someone who knows how to spend money on what he really likes. And Peter loves sailing. In 1983, he financed Britain's America's Cup effort, a hugely expensive sailing challenge against teams from the US and Australia.
The day of the summer, as the British Syndicate's weather team tested the wind, at least 50 knots, perfect for Victory 83. Out in Newport Sound, the British and Australians warily circle each other, jockeying for position before the starting gun. Then, in a daring maneuver, Victory cut through the spectator fleet, including our own motorboat. Without any hesitation at all, the Australians followed, with their masts scraping a radio antenna. They were within 3 feet of us.
Hang on, Kim.
By then, they'd lost the starting advantage to Victory.
What did you have at age 17 that made you want to drop out of school and take this chance? What did you have inside of you?
Well, I think I had a huge ambition for freedom and independence. I'd been sent to a boarding school in England. I found it very restrictive. I found it very rigid. I didn't enjoy it at all. Those who say your school days are the best days of your life, I'm sure they are for some people. For me, they were probably the worst days of my life. And my yearning for freedom to go out and be creative, to have an adventure, to be a pioneer.
But Peter, I don't hear the phrase that you wanted to make money. Was that a driving force?
No, it was never a driving force that motivated me, that I wanted to make money. No, I wanted an adventure. I wanted a challenge. I wanted to be a pioneer. I wanted to take on the world. I wanted to be creative. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to enjoy people, go places. Making money never actually featured. I think I just probably naively assumed that if I was a good adventurer, I'd probably make enough money to pay my bills and meet my commitment.
So what happened when you made your first £1 million? Did you go wild?
No.
I'm curious.
I've only gone wild once in my life, I think, in a financial sense, and that's when I challenged for the America's Cup in the USA in 1983, and I would call that going wild and being reckless, but in itself, it was also a great and wonderful adventure that I shared with a lot of other people.
The Victory crew entered the latest race knowing they mustn't lose. They won the toss and chose the favourable starboard position. And by shrewd sailing, Victory led the Australians at the starting gun, but not for long. But Peter de Savary, the syndicate boss, was making no excuses.
Well, we wish there was more sea, but that Australian boat is just a very, very good boat.
That simple truth was underscored by the Australian margin of superiority, 3 minutes, 20 seconds at the finish.
I never went actually wild, no. I sort of subscribed to the Andrew Carnegie philosophy, which he wrote to a friend in a letter, that is to be wasteful is a sin, to be extravagant is a conscious decision. So as I'm conscious about those decisions, you can choose what to be extravagant with and not. You know, you can only wear so many suits at a time. You only need a house with so many bedrooms and so many acres. And that people go to extremes and excesses, and what they'll spend on a house to live in and call home or one of their homes are perhaps way over the top, almost to the point of embarrassment. And I think the same thing with yachts. I think some of the yachts that we see are just over the top. I mean, they're completely unnecessary. They're just sort of I'm super rich statements. And I would put that in the category of Andrew Carnegie's words as being just wasteful, frankly. It's beyond being extravagant. And I try not to, not to participate in that. And, you know, by the same token, he said to die rich is to die disgraced. You know, at the end of the day, after you've reasonably provided for your loved ones without it being excessive, or over extravagant, everybody should earn their own way in life, basically. You know, you've managed to leave behind some sort of legacies that will help areas or people that genuinely do need it.
Are you leaving all of your wealth to your children?
No, absolutely not. No.
What's your reasoning behind this?
I can't think of any. I have five wonderful, lovely daughters. They're the most important thing in my life. Always have been, always will be, I'm sure. And the notion that I should have five son-in-laws who are all going to loll around on the fruits of my hard work over 50-plus years would turn me in the grave, I think. I couldn't. That would be dreadful, wouldn't it?
Peter's attitude is not unusual among entrepreneurs. The money is often not the primary benefit, but the secondary benefit of their success. Making an idea work or winning at a competition is the primary driving force for them. They often assume that the money will simply eventually come. Back at the Sugar Daddy event, I'm having a look around. There's a door that leads to a VIP area. So clearly those people who paid the higher entry fees up to $1,000 have their own separate area where, according to the website, they'll be introduced to hand-picked, college-educated sugar babies. I want to meet one of those. We're in the VIP area, which is actually laid out rather nicely. They have setups here where you can get your dum or your vodka or your Courvoisier. The ladies here have been specially chosen, and they are quite decked out. Beautiful, beautiful, actually. The guys look a little Vegas-y. Shirt collars open, a little portly, but you know.
You can't have press in here.
Okay.
Okay.
So the thing is, they were promised that things would be very discreet in here, so right. We can't have.
So I was just kicked out of the VIP area because we cannot talk to anybody, we cannot approach anybody. Because these people paid a higher sum, they have the right to an area where they can be completely discreet and removed from the press. I guess that's what $1,000 buys. I'm still determined to speak to a sugar baby.
My name's Victoria.
When you heard the name Sugar Daddies, Sugar Babies, what went through your mind?
Well, I know there's a stigma attached to it, but I don't really think about that much. I think about like meeting people who are interested. I'm trying to get into marketing, so I'm interested in making connections and getting to know people that I can make any connection with. So
this isn't about solely a relationship for you.
No.
It's more like a networking thing.
It's networking, definitely. Oh. I have goals. I plan on going to grad school. I have things that I plan on accomplishing. So. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about.
Let's see. So if you met somebody here who would support you in that, that would be a good thing.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good thing.
Do you think that some of the women here came with money on their mind at the first thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm certain that a lot of women came here tonight with money on their mind, you know? So, I mean, but I can't look down on that. Like, that's their prerogative entirely.
What are your goals for the evening?
My goals for the evening are to introduce myself and to meet very, very nice, interesting people that I feel like I can maybe turn, you know, make something of it, like make something of the afternoon or the evening, you know, so that's what I'm.
And what are the do's and the don'ts you've given yourself?
Do be nice, but don't be too nice.
When thinking of bling, would you think of someone who looked like this?
He would always wear, I mean, he would look like a poor man. He would look like a pauper. His sweaters had holes in them. He really liked to have a look that was, no one would ever guess that he was a wealthy man. And I think that when he did pass away, that people were absolutely shocked because one would have never in a million years guessed that he was worth the money, half the money that he was worth.
When most people think of bling or showing off cash, I bet they think of flashy cars and expensive purchases that signpost in glittering lights that this person has money. Jack McDonald wasn't like that. By all appearances, a frugal man. And his neighbors would not have suspected that upon his death, he would bequeath $187 million to charity, 40% to the Children's Hospital of Seattle in America. Despite what his stepdaughter, Regan Dennis, suggests, I think Jack was such an interesting character.
Quite frankly, he was a pretty boring guy. Jack also, though, was a very frugal man, extremely frugal, to the point of being sort of a joke about how frugal he was. He was fine with, for example, when they would travel, he could write the big check for the cruise or the tour, but he had really hard times buying the one extra glass of wine or the if you pay an extra dollar, you got a dessert. And he had a hard time doing that. He was very, very frugal when it came down to the nickels and dimes of spending money. So in I guess in summary, Jack wasn't a gregarious man at all. He was very, very quiet, liked to observe what was going on, but he grew into being certainly a social man in the sense that he could carry on a conversation and liked being around people, but he never, never, never talked about his money. Never. And he was always a person, however, if the topic came up about the stock market or about the economy, he would always weigh in on that, but never in a personal basis. It was always just background knowledge.
I bet you're still wondering why I think this man enjoyed a little of the bling that comes with money. Well, Jack McDonald himself lived a comfortable life from the money he made, but he had inherited the responsibility for a $2 million trust. He invested that money in the stock market, growing it over the decades until it reached the huge sum that he finally left to charity. He was the guardian of that money, and while he was determined not to lavish money on himself, he did enjoy one aspect of it.
In putting together his obituary, I wrote a great deal about his life, and then the big question came, what do you want to be remembered as? And Jack sat for a few minutes and he said, I want to be remembered as a philanthropist, as a smart person who worked to help other people. And what was so interesting is that he did not want recognition for that while he was living. He wanted quiet recognition. For example, when he went to the annual luncheon at Children's Hospital, which was a lovely event every year, and I went with him after my mother passed away in 1999, I was his date every year. And just by being invited to the Guardian Circle luncheon indicated that you were in the upper levels of philanthropy for Children's Hospital, because that's all they invited. It was a small event, and it was a recognition event for those benefactors who were giving large amounts of money. Jack very much liked being in that room. He liked being recognized by his peer group, if you will, other people who believed in philanthropy and other people who recognized the potential of his philanthropy.
The only people who knew about the trust were the main charity and his close family, but they didn't know the magnitude of it. Jack was someone who very carefully stewarded this money, investing in blue-chip stocks, ignoring young tech companies. Doug Pica of Seattle Children's Foundation became friends with Jack over the years.
Jack was a very practical guy, and I think he knew that this would change relationships with if his friends, for example, in the apartment home that he lived in knew that he had that kind of money. I think, you know, he would joke. In fact, he said, I really don't want anybody knocking on my door. And he said that both from, you know, he didn't want anyone to court him, and he didn't want, you know, solicitations. And so I thought perhaps it would just be a lot easier. And he said, you know, oftentimes we would say, you know, because we honor Jack by naming a building for his gift. And before he passed, we'd asked him if we had his permission to do that. And he said, you know, you can do anything you want after I pass, but not until then.
Jack was very old school in his attitude toward money. He knew that he had to handle it responsibly, But he also wanted to enjoy just a little bit of the benefits that this money provided. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now, back to the party.
Walking through the crowd, you just hear some of the best lines ever. One guy turned to a very beautiful blonde woman and said to her, "Are you stalking me?" And she said, "I just walked in." The other one was a guy talking to this group of three women, and he was talking about the luxury of his life, that he could afford to play golf when he wanted to. He could have a country house and a big apartment in the city. And they were clearly all like laser beam focused on him. And he knew it. And you could just watch him grow taller and taller because he was about 5'6" tall. It was very good to see. Other lines are, "What are you here for tonight?" "I'm here looking for somebody good. Are you?" Some great lines.
Finally, after 2 hours of searching, a sugar daddy, who asks to remain anonymous, is willing to speak to me about why he showed up tonight.
"You know, I'm a busy person, I work a lot, and I thought it would just be an easier way to kind of meet somebody, and I don't really have time necessarily to devote to, you know, the whole shebang that goes with a relationship."
Did the fact that you were called a sugar daddy on the website bother you at all, that people would look at you and see Daddy Warbucks?
No, that actually didn't bother me. I've been called worse. So,
do you think a lot of people come here with money on their minds?
Probably the sugar babies come here with money on their minds. I would imagine that. So,
looking around the event, it's very clear that the women have put a lot more effort than the guys in making themselves attractive. Would you agree?
I would agree, yes. But then again, I'm not really looking at the guys, so.
Do you think that's part of how they want to make you attractive to them, to get you, to allure you there?
Absolutely, I mean.
And does it work?
Sometimes, yes. Depends on the girl.
What would make this night a success for you?
Meeting a beautiful woman who I could have a good arrangement with. You know, for me personally, it's maybe a few times a month. You know, just dinners, movies, you know, obviously some intimate time and just enjoy yourselves. And obviously on our side, on the guy's side, we help out with some sort of allowance or something to help girls out that are having some trouble.
Yeah, so it's, you really are being a benefactor in essence.
Yes.
How do you find the courage, how do you find the resources to start again, Peter?
Well, it's the thrill of the chase, it's the adrenaline. You have to have a very, very positive attitude. That means whenever somebody presents you with an idea, whenever you get an idea, whenever you see an opportunity or a circumstance, you instantly only see all the positives in it.
If you woke up tomorrow and all your money had gone, everything, two questions, Peter. What would you miss about your current life the most? And do you think you could rebuild?
Well, firstly, of all the material trappings, I wouldn't miss them at all. I wouldn't miss the big yacht and the crew at all. I could have a rowing boat. I could have a 12-foot sailing dinghy pulled up on the beach somewhere because I could certainly, in the space of a couple of weeks, earn enough money to buy a 12-foot sailing dinghy. I wouldn't miss the big houses and all the beautiful things and the wonderful cars. And I'd be very, very happy living in a treehouse or so long as in the countryside, preferably near the sea, it could almost be a shack. I would then absolutely focus on how I could improve my lot. And that would actually be my biggest challenge of all. It does get harder as you get older, but I'm totally convinced that if everything disappeared tomorrow morning, I would very quickly find something that I could go to work on and I would get going again. And in a perverse way, I think I'd love it.
Peter, it sounds like you identify more with old money than new money. You reference Carnegie, right, who was much more of a prudent person. So you're not going to go out and buy the gold watch and have the women in their bikinis on your yacht, are you?
No, that's not my style. That's not my scene. I'm not a big party goer. I have just a few friends. You can still be a little flamboyant. You can be eccentric. You can do these things in a nice way. I don't know. I think in some ways I'm a little old-fashioned. If I'm honest, I would have rather been born at the turn of the last century when it was all happening and the whole world was alive with the Industrial Revolution and pioneering and adventure.
But then, Peter, you would have been known as Peter de Savory, robber baron.
That's all right, too, because, you know, there were good robber barons and bad robber barons. So if I was in the Robin Hood category, I'll go for that.
There are many ways that people show their bling. Some people wear their wealth, seeing it as a way to open doors to new relationships, different levels of society, and more money. Others see their wealth as a way of enjoying it during their lifetime, while at the same time benefiting others. There are many ways of enjoying your money, some flashy, some classy. Thank goodness the world is a diverse place. Document.